floats. Shuler for the benediction. Of course, the leaders of the Church of the Open Door out here could take them swimming in the suburbs. I'm just doing my little part to try to restore the Church to at least the level of the 17th century. Let's skip to the third company. Am I boring you? The third company of the translators composed of Oxford divines. From Cambridge, we go to Oxford. What we have here is a committee that would be analogous to setting up a committee of 10 at Stanford, a committee of 8 at Harvard, a committee of 8 at Princeton. Of course, I saw Jimmy Swaggart waving the King James around and turning his nose up with this. Oh, as only he can sneer, Harvard professors and Princeton professors. Well, you know, when you can't get within a stone's throw of the place, the best you can do is throw rocks at them. I'll tell you something. Sister Sal would be an improvement on what we're witnessing among the television evangelists right now. And she's pretty low. Third company of translators composed of Oxford divines met at that famous seat of learning and was fully equal to any of the other companies and qualifications for their undertaking. The part assigned to this division was from the beginning of Isaiah to the end of the Old Testament. So three companies handle the Old Testament. This third company takes it from Isaiah to the Old Testament. I'll pick up with John Harding after we listen to Sister Sal, and you tell me if you want me to continue. Give me the music.
Thank you.
Translators Revived, Biographical Notes of the King James Version of the Bible by Alexander McClure. Just doing my part to point out that the church doesn't have to be led by such dim-witted jaybirds as the current TV evangelist crop that seem to be grabbing all the headlines. The church is going to survive. And I'm embarrassed that the church has to be represented in the minds of the world by such jerks. John Harding was president of the company, the third company of translators that met at Oxford, who handled the section of the King James from Isaiah to the end of the Old Testament. At the time of his appointment to aid in the translation of the Bible, he had been the royal professor of Hebrew in the university for 13 years. His occupancy of that chair at a time when the study of sacred literature was pursued by thousands with a zeal amounting to a passion. It is a fair intimation that Dr. Harding was the man selected as the royal professor of Hebrew in the university when commissioned by the king to take part in this version of the scriptures. He was also president of Magdalen College. He was at the same time rector of Halsey in Oxfordshire. The share which he, with his fellows, performed was perhaps the most difficult portion of the translation work. John Reynolds, also of the Third Company. This famous divine, though he died in the course of the good work, deserves a special mention, because it was by his means that the good work itself was undertaken. He was born in Penhoe in Devonshire in the year 1549. He entered the university at the age of 13. Spent all of his days within its precincts. Though he at first entered Merton College in 1562, he was chiefly bred at Corpus Christi, which he entered the next year, and where he became a fellow in 1566 at the early age of 17. 6 years later, 23 years of age, he was made Greek lecturer in his college. About this time occurred one of the most singular events in the history of religious controversy. John Reynolds was a zealous papist. His brother William, who was his fellow student, was equally zealous for Protestantism. Each in fraternal anxiety for the salvation of a brother's soul, labored for the conversion of the other, and each of them was successful. As a result of long conference and disputation, William changed from being a zealous Protestant to become an inveterate papist, and so lived and died. While John, the zealous papist, became a decided Protestant of the Puritan stamp and continued to his death to be a vigorous champion of the Reformation. Well, if nothing else can be said about them, they were convincing. From the time of his conversion, he was a most able and successful preacher of God's Word. Well, I've warned you. Are you getting convinced that all Christians aren't dummies? Having very greatly distinguished himself in the year 1578 as a debater in the theological discussions, he was drawn into the popish controversy, determined to explore the whole field and make himself master of the subject. He devoted himself to the study of the scriptures in the original tongues and read all the Greek and Latin fathers and all the ancient records of the church. No nor did this flood of reading roll out of his mind as fast as it poured in. It is stated that his memory was little less than miraculous. He could readily turn to any material passage in every leaf, page, column, and paragraph of the numerous and voluminous works he had read. He came to be styled the very treasury of erudition, and was spoken of as a living library and a third university. About the year 1578, John Hart, a popish zealot, challenged all the learned men in the nation to a public debate. At the solicitation of one of Queen Elizabeth's privy counselors, Mr. Reynolds took him on. After several combats, the Romish champion owned himself driven from the field. An account of the conferences subscribed by both parties was published and widely circulated. This added greatly to the reputation of Mr. Reynolds, who soon after took his degrees in divinity and was appointed by the Queen to be Royal Professor of Divinity in the university. At that time, the celebrated Cardinal Bellarmine, the Goliath of the Philistines at Rome, was professor of theology in the English seminary at that city. As fast as he delivered his popish doctrine, it was taken down in writing and regularly sent to Dr. Reynolds, who from time to time publicly confuted it at Oxford. Thus, Bellarmine's books were answered even before they were printed. It is said that Reynolds' professorship was founded by the royal bounty. They weren't all selling what they had and giving to the poor. His professorship was founded by the royal bounty. Now, of course, the royal bounty was from the head of the church, for the express purpose of strengthening the Church of England against the Church of Rome and of widening the breach between them, and that Dr. Reynolds was first placed in the chair on that account because of his strenuous opposition to the corruptions of Rome. On and on and on. His accomplishments. Notwithstanding that Elizabeth, the Queen, was no lover of men puritanically inclined, she felt constrained to notice the eminent gifts and services of Dr. Reynolds. In 1598, she made him Dean of Lincoln and offered him a bishopric. He refused that, preferring his studious academic life to the wealth and honors of any ecclesiastical station. He resigned his deanery in less than a year and then was chosen president of Corpus Christi College, in which office he was exceedingly active and useful till his death. King James appointed him in 1603 to be one of the four who would represent Puritan interests at the Hampton Court Conference. Here he was almost the only speaker on his side of the question. And he died while the work was going forward. Thomas Holland, born in Ludlow. Am I born here? In Shrop, I'm not going to read them all, I'm skipping along now. In Shropshire in the year 1539. Educated at Exeter College, Oxford, graduated in 1570 with great applause. 3 years after, is made chaplain and fellow of Balliol College, and as Anthony Wood says, was another Apollos, mighty in the Scriptures, a most noted disputant and most learned divine. made doctor in divinity in 1584. The next year, when Robert Dudley, the famous Earl of Leicester, was sent as governor of the Netherlands, then just emancipated from the Spanish yoke, Dr. Holland went with him in the capacity of chaplain. In 1589, he succeeded the celebrated Dr. Lawrence Humphrey as the King's Professor of Divinity. Elected rector of Exeter College in 1592, an office he filled with great reputation for 20 years, being regarded as a universal scholar and a prodigy of literature. His reputation extended to the continent, and he was held in high esteem in the universities of Europe. In the translation of our Bible, he took a very prominent part. This was the crowning work of his life. He died March 16, 1612, a few months after this most important version was completed and published. He attained to the age of 73 years. Dr. Kilby preached his funeral sermon, and in this sermon said of him, "He had a wonderful knowledge of all the learned languages and of all arts and sciences, both human and divine. He was mighty in scriptures, so familiarly acquainted with the fathers as if he himself had been one of them, and so versed in the schoolmen as if he were the seraphic doctor. He was therefore most worthy of the divinity chair, which he filled about 20 years with distinguished approbation and applause." None of them very dumb, are they? Huh? You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Get on the telephone. You got to talk back to me a little. I want to go to those that handle the New Testament. None of them are very dumb. I wonder if this had occurred in the 20th century, if Jerry Falwell, Jimmy Swaggart, and Jim Baker would have been appointed. Of course, Tammy would have had to help. They are not what Christianity has been represented by down through the centuries, and I will not sit silent and let the whole church be put on the defensive because of those jerks. If you agree, get on the telephone. Give me. I don't like it.
This and crazy to be upset or acting mean. Musicians must not play too loud.
Well, let's take a look at this one. Let's skip way down the line. The sixth and last company of King James Bible translators met at Cambridge. To this company was assigned all the apocryphal books. Interesting, huh? One whole company at Cambridge to translate the apocryphal books, which were in the King James at the time of the translation. Of course, don't tell Jimmy Swaggart that. He might die of shock. And don't tell Jimmy Swaggart that. It might put him into a bondage to have to read some of the inerrant books. To this company was assigned all the apocryphal books, which in those times were more read and accounted of than now. This party of the translators had as much to do in the repeated revision of the version of the canonical books as any other group. Let's look at number one, John Duport. The president of this company, those who translated the apocryphal books, was Dr. Duport, then master of Jesus College and prebendary of Ely. He was the son of Thomas Duport, Esquire, and was born at Shepsheed in Leicestershire, and was bred at Jesus College, Cambridge, where he became fellow and afterwards master, which later office he exercised with great reputation for nearly 30 years. He was a liberal benefactor of the college. That means he wasn't poor. He was a liberal benefactor of the college. In 1580, he was proctor in the university, and in the same year was made rector of Harleton and Cambridgeshire. He afterwards bestowed the perpetual advowsance. Now write that word down, A-D-V-O-W-S-A-N-C-E. He afterwards bestowed the perpetual advowsance of this rectory on his college. That means he owned the advowsance, and he gave it to his college. And what's the advowsance? You'll see. He was soon after rector of Bosworth and Medburn in his native county. In 1583, he was collated to the rectory of Fulham in Middlesex, which was a sinecure. Let's keep going. Such frequent change of parishes in a clergyman of the Anglican Church is a sign of great prosperity, as they are always changes from a poorer benefice to a better and are considered as preferments. We call them perks. Instead of going down, they advanced. Almost every parish, where whenever vacant, is in the gift of some man of wealth or high officer in church, state, university, or other corporation. Hence, frequent removals to more desirable parishes tend to show that a clergyman has very influential friends or is in high esteem. The person who has the right of presenting a clergyman to be a pastor of a vacant church is called the patron, and the right of presentation is called the advowson. These advowsons are bought, sold, bequeathed, or inherited, like any other right or possession. They may be owned by heretics or infidels who are under very little restraint as to their choice of ministers to fill the vacancies that occur. If the bishop should refuse to institute the person nominated, it would involve the prelate in great trouble, unless he could make out a very strong case against the fitness of the rejected presentee. Meanwhile, Why don't the news media get on this? Meanwhile, the flocks who pay the tithes which support the minister have no voice in the matter except in comparatively few parishes. They must take the shepherd who is set over them. If they dislike his pasture and jump the fences to feed elsewhere, they must pay tithes and offerings all the same to the convivial rector, fox hunting vicar, or Pusiite priest who has secured the benefits or living. It is astonishing, this writer says, that such a system can be endured to the middle of such a century as this by a nation whose loudest and proudest boast is that of liberty. These scholars recognized that those who paid the tithes had no say in what happened to the tithes. Like the system or don't like the system, it's as old as the Levites who went bad in the Old Testament. God's problem. It's his tithe. Oh, but we just can't really trust God to set up a system that will correct itself when it goes bad. God needs our help, you know, to rearrange his system periodically. I thought you'd enjoy that one. It's got a little modern touch to it. Am I boring you? Get on a telephone. You want me to continue any of this teaching? I'd like to go back in the next festival to the earlier centuries again, but I'm going to string one of these along ever so often to remind you don't have to be dumb to be a preacher.